Captain's Table is alive and well. Got a great guest in today, and I'd like to introduce James Balderstone.
Thank you, Jimmy.
Welcome to the Captain's Table.
Pleasure to be here. Looking forward to it.
Slightly nervous. I'm not sure if it's the hat, the shirt, the room.
Well, look, this isn't an interrogation. I want you to just relax and just enjoy yourself on the table. But no, it's great to have you on board. And just today, I want to have a little chat about a guy that's been here for 20 odd years. How long in the Middle East?
Yeah, so coming out here since the mid 90s. And living here since 2006.
2006, but the beginning start where?
So I grew up as a bit of an expat kid, I guess. My dad was an engineer, worked for a big American firm building bridges and tanks and interesting stuff like that. So
whereabouts?
Yeah, all over. So when I was born in Holland, but you didn't know that. And
it's first one right there down.
And then we did a stint when we were very little. I've got two sisters. My second sister and I, we lived in Nigeria and Kenya up until the age of three. And then a bit of sort of time in different countries, like we were in the States for a bit, Indonesia for a very long time, for about 6 years. So I'm fluent in Indonesian. Again, do you want to maybe write that down?
I just can't believe that you know someone for 20 years and you have no idea what their history is.
Yeah. So grew up younger years as an expat, but then I think mum and dad were pretty keen to get us back to Australia to do secondary school in Oz. So was back there for all of secondary school and university. And then and mum and dad sort of somewhere in the middle there, they continued. You know, they were in Australia for secondary school, but then they got opportunities to go back abroad. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, engineering, you know, dad did some amazing projects. Like he built the bridge over the Mekong River in Vietnam. He, you know, he ran that project, which connected the country. Pretty amazing project. He did a lot of really cool stuff. So I think it's fairly limited, maybe, the opportunities in Oz, and pretty excited to travel the world and do things. So they came here in, like, I'm not exactly sure, but I think it was like 1996. So I was then at uni,
and that was the first time they had been here.
Dad was here in the 70s.
Okay,
for a couple of years. So
building bridges.
Bit of history for you. So where Madinat Jumeirah is, Madinat Jumeirah and Jumeirah Beach Hotel. If you speak to people who've been here long enough, they call that Chicago Beach.
Chicago Beach?
And it was called Chicago Beach because it was actually the accommodation for a construction company called Chicago Bridge and Iron, CBI, and that was Dad's company. So he was out here in the 70s building tanks in Ras El Khaimah and stuff like that. Beautiful, beautiful tanks. But then he had a bit of familiarity. Obviously, it changed a lot from the 70s to the late 90s. And then he moved out here with mum and no kids. My little sister was boarding then. And my other sister and I were in university. And we used to come out occasionally for like a Christmas holiday they were here for a while. And I sort of got familiar with the place. And, you know, the first visit was pretty crazy, very hot, quite overwhelming. With just the amount of construction going on. But then, you know, from, say, the late 90s until the early 2000s, you know, just insane growth. And
but was that, I mean, obviously we think about the construction 2000s, but what was the big things that were happening then?
I think in the late 90s it was sort of finding its feet. You know, there was, like, mum, for example, actually, another friend of ours, Dave Battiston, that's how we know those guys, is they live next door to each other in a building in Bur Dubai. But a lot of people live down there. They live down near the creek and in Satwa, a lot of villas in Satwa. And then there was kind of nothing all the way up Shakeside Road until you got to Emirates Golf Course.
Yeah.
You know, like, like not literally nothing, but not much.
There were the little pockets.
Yeah, little pockets.
Yeah.
So, you know, they used – so when I first came, you'd, you know, go and mum used to be a member at the golf club, so you'd, you know, go down there to check it out, and there was nothing in between. And then over the next few years, you know, there's – so, buildings popping up everywhere.
So by that stage, you'd finished school?
Yeah, so I finished school '94,
yeah.
Got a scholarship to go to England, went over there for a year, coaching sport, and and then went back to uni in '96.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, and so I believe that because you're a landscape architect, I'll let the cat out of the bag now for the listeners that don't know. You didn't – that's not your original study.
No, so probably like a lot of kids, I was quite confused when I sort of finished school, didn't really know what I wanted to do. A lot of pressure on, I think you put it on yourself about, you know, you've got to make this decision that your degree is your life and your future, and you're only 17. Like I was young, so I was only 17, and you don't really know. Yeah. You know, I don't know if I want to be an engineer, an architect, a you know, a stockbroker, a surfy bum. I just don't know, right? So, and the degrees are quite, I think they're quite, you know, you can do a general degree like an arts degree, but they're fairly narrow, I guess, in, you know, if you some degrees, certainly if you do them, you know, you're fairly stuck in that career path. So I didn't know what I wanted to do, and everyone told me I should do a sort of a general degree, economics. I majored in Asian studies, and I did that at the Australian National University in Canberra.
Asian studies.
Yeah, so and majored in Indonesian because I kind of a bit of a cheat. Like I'd obviously grown up there, so I could sort of speak it. And, and then so the idea was I'd be a businessman in Southeast Asia. I had a real affinity for Indonesia from living there. And yeah, a lot of opportunity. Love the country. Love the coast. Love surfing. So seemed like the dream. Go and be a big swinging businessman in Indonesia, and then
case closed,
and then I finished that degree in 90. What would that have been? So I started in 96. So say 2000, 99, 2000. But then at the Asian bubble must have been around then. So like Southeast Asia crapped itself, and there was just zero opportunities in that space. Not through my grades, but through some networks, I got a gig for Citigroup on their graduate program. So they used to split that. You do half equities, half investment banking.
So no more Indonesian businessmen. I'm going to be a banker.
Yeah, well, I'm just still pretty lost.
Sure.
And, you know, it was really weird. Like, it was again, I just really didn't know what I wanted to do, but it seemed like a good idea, and you sort of like, opportunity through a friend is thrown at you. And most of the graduates who get in there have got, like, a TER or a score, university, high school score of, like, 100, university score of, you know, high distinctions. Yeah. And I'm, like, struggle street. But because I knew someone got in there. And but like a lot of things, I think, you know, application and kind of common sense and, you know, being good in a team environment tend to help. And I actually got offered a job to stay there, but by that time, after that 6 months or whatever it was, I realised I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
So, I went back to uni and complete change, no carryover points and wanted to be creative, wanted to be involved in building somehow, construction. So architecture and majoring in landscape architecture seemed like a good idea. Went back down to Canberra. I was familiar with that. Much probably to mum and dad's, you know, panic at the time. What's he doing? but, you know, it just wasn't for me. And, you know, it's just a very different space. Like I remember the first morning I went in there to the office, we used to have to get in there at 6 in your suit and catch the train to get in there. And that was that you all the analysts would come in, and then you have all the brokers, and you'd all be in one room, and the analysts would give a recap on, you know, America or what had happened overnight, and what they thought was happening in different sectors, and the brokers would sit there and give their 10 cents, and then off you'd go. And I'd been surfing all summer, and I'd a friend of mine had put some like a dye in my hair, I'd fallen asleep, and he'd put it was like a, I forget what you call it. It was like a blondener. But he put way too much, and because I fell asleep, my hair just completely bleached, so it was white, and I had these dirty kind of roots coming through, and I'm about to go in for this big job opportunity in Citigroup with bleach white hair with black roots, and I just couldn't do it. So I went to a hairdresser and I said, "Can you do anything with this?" And the hairdresser said, "Well, not really, because basically there's, you know, your hair's stuffed, but we can kind of try and dye it like a mousy brown." So I went in there, and for the first day my hair was mousy brown for about a week, and then that sort of slowly washed out, and then by the end of the week I just looked ridiculous and no one took me seriously for about a month. But it just wasn't for me, you know. I wanted to be outside. I wanted to be in the great outdoors a bit more at that time. So
you made the decision.
Yep.
Landscape, architecture, 4 years?
Three years. I have a few carryover points, not many, so 3 years.
Yeah. Qualified?
Yeah.
Little certificate?
What'd you do? Yeah, actually went really well at that, I think, because I was a bit more passionate about it.
Yeah, sure.
I did well with my grades there, and then when I finished that degree, they had an award in the country, in the whole of Australia, called the AILA Award, which is the institution award, mm-hmm. and they gave it to a graduate every year, and I was lucky enough to get that, which then basically gave me an amazing opportunity in terms of careers and job, because every company, big company wanted, they wanted that graduate. So I was obviously coming back to Dubai every now and then, and for my space, like construction, development,
landscape. But you always, even after the degree, your plan was to head offshore again.
I wasn't really sure, but I think that was setting the seeds, those trips back here.
Yeah.
And then, I'd go and come out here just like in that 6 months or a year, so much had changed.
Yeah.
And it just seemed unbelievable. And then I go back to Australia, and you know, it's pretty slow, consistent, very structured. And then I worked in Sydney when I finished that. I got a job in a design firm in Sydney. And I think I really just did that to tick a box, just to get the 1 year under my belt in a big design firm. I wanted to be more in construction, design and build, but it was really just to tick a box, I think. It's so difficult to grow. Like you've got to do your time. You know, you got to do 5 years as a CAD guy. It's pretty hard to sort of get that client facing, designing, seeing your stuff. Unless somehow you're just a freak and someone backs you, or you just get a lucky break. It's pretty hard. Mm. You sort of don't get recognized. You know, you got to do your time. So, and I was a bit older. So I lived in the eastern suburbs of Sydney, and I was about a 10-minute drive to work. And, I mean, I had a pretty good life. I lived in Paddington actually at the time, and I used to be able to go for a surf every morning at Tamarama Beach and then drive to work. Like, life was good.
Yeah, you know, right.
5 minutes to work from Tamar, have a shower on the beach.
Yep.
But I don't think it was sort of challenging enough. And after a year, I'd done some work experience here during my uni degrees, and those guys were in touch with me and sort of saying, "Look, when are you coming?
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, let's go. So I packed my bags and came to Dubai.
Jumped on the plane.
Yeah.
But mum and dad weren't here.
No, then. They were.
They were here.
So that was another reason. Yeah, I hadn't lived in the same country as them for probably 10 years.
Yeah.
10 years or something. So it was really cool to be able to.
Yeah, of course.
Live with them again and see
and
them.
And your sisters were here?
One of them was. Because she had a big accident, broken her back badly, and she was sort of out here and rehabbing. And it just
Yeah.
It just seemed like the right thing to do. Like sure. It seemed like I was a bit older. I was going to get frustrated in Sydney and Australia
yeah.
unless I did my own thing. I wasn't really ready to do my own thing. I could come out here, accelerate that experience and sure. growth, and hang out with mum and dad a bit and see them. Mm. So, yeah, initially, you know, I think they were, there was a crossover where we were in the same place together for a year because then – or 6 months because then dad got transferred to China.
Okay.
As luck would have it. So that was a bit unfortunate, but it was really fun having them around. Yeah.
But then you're here, you're set up, and you started with
– So I ended up scouting around and there were a few big landscape operators and the biggest at the time was Desert Group.
Yep.
They had sort of they had good coverage in every mm. sector. They had like the garden center, retail. They mm. had you know, huge nurseries where they did all their production of plants. Mm. And they were building all the biggest projects. You know, they just built the Royal Mirage. They just built Madden Atchamira.
Okay. So when you compare to what you would have been doing in Australia. To what you were doing, what you started doing here, what was the main difference?
Well, they were a construction company. Mm-hmm. So I was working purely in design in Australia. So, you know, I was very much office bound. And, you know, because of the Australian processes and regulations, you'd do a design, but then it'd have to go through government approval process. It'd just take a long time.
Sure,
and then
sure.
you'd see your design executed. Maybe you wouldn't see it executed.
Okay, okay. So in Australia, you would have been, as you've said, office bound, but then here, are you thrown completely in front of a customer?
Yeah, so in Oz, I was a designer only, and you wouldn't, you know, I think I was saying you would see stuff executed, take a long time with approvals and processes, whereas here, you'd draw a line in the sand, and like literally a week later, there'd be a wall, like because everything was moving so fast.
Sure.
You didn't have anywhere near the approval processes, you know? So I literally landed off a plane and the owner of Desert Group, who'd established the business like 25 years before, he's an amazing guy. He just said, I've got a project I need you to get on immediately. And I thought, you know, awesome. I didn't have anything. I didn't have a desk or a computer or like they were just trying to get things moving for me.
Yeah.
And that was for the Burj Al Arab.
Right.
So like... You know, they
just a small starting point.
So it was their executive pool and kind of lounge area for all their VIP guests.
Right.
And the guy who was the head of Jamira had an office in the top of the Burj Al Arab, looking down over all their properties because they had JBH Madden out there.
Yeah.
And we met up in his office, Gerald Lawless, and he sort of had all of his, you know, he had a big outfit then. He was the man.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I've had months of designs being done. Here are the designs. They're all organic shaped. Look out the window. Is anything organic shaped? Which it wasn't. Mm-hmm. It's all the, you know, traditional Arabic sort of architecture, wind towers and all that stuff. And he said, come up with a new design, but I need this thing built in 4 months. So the hotel was really busy, you know, like crazy busy.
Mm-hmm.
Just Jamira Beach Hotel was... You know, 95% occupancy,
and the Burj was running there,
and the Burj was running, Madinat was running.
So it was the flashiest place in the world. Everyone was going.
There was nothing really else done, right? The Royal Mirage was a bit further up the road, but then that was it. And so the hotel had, you know, booked this construction period, informed all their guests that it was going to be built in that window of 3 months, and that date was starting in like 2 weeks, and we didn't have a design.
Okay.
So you can imagine the panic. Like you can't go outside of that window because that's when guests have been informed. It was a pretty rude shock and welcome to Dubai.
Yeah. So your role within it is you draw it, you design it, you present it, you get sign off on it, and then you carry on
So then I built it. I oversaw the build of it.
So you oversee
design
the build.
And build. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So it's like a turnkey service to the customer, which no one was really doing then for landscaping.
Yeah.
Usually they'd go to a design firm to design it, and then that would be tendered and a company would build that design.
Mm.
But I was really keen to do design and build, and the guy who owned Desert was keen to establish that division. So I had the design background, construction experience from, you know, doing that in Oz, and then just applied the two. So it was very different, you know, like thousands of labourers and just everything was very different. Like it's not comparable to how you operate construction sites in Oz, as I'm sure you know. But yeah, I mean, exciting. Like, you know, we had machines digging up this site on the beach in front of the Burj Al Arab.
Yeah.
And we hadn't had a design signed off. That's how tight programs
were.
Yeah, it was really, really great way to, like, you know, working double shift all day, all night, and 4 months, you know, turnaround.
And I'm presuming you delivered on time.
Yeah, we delivered on time, and you know, he was the client. Were extremely happy. It was a great way for me to build a team and understand how things worked here.
And then did that. Was it similar to that, moving on of different projects?
Yeah, fairly similar. I then built a division in the company that was specialising in design and build. Mm-hmm. So we do anything from hotels to resorts. And then we wanted to expand the company into doing golf course construction, which we weren't doing. That was a sort of specialist thing that other companies did. So we set up a golf course division. We won the project for Jumeirah Golf Estates for the Greg Norman courses, which is where I met Stu Donald, who was working for them then. And I think building the relationship with Stu, being able to design and do a lot of the design around the golf course for Greg Norman was a real value add and got us kind of in there. And you know, with Stu's support, we got into golf course construction, beautiful golf courses that we built.
But it must have been high pressure with just deadlines hanging over you the whole time.
Everything was just so fast.
Yeah.
But also budgets were big, money was being spent, you know.
And what about if as an architect, you know, you obviously want the perfect finished product. You must have had the fine line sometimes.
I think there's like a compromise between, you know, just getting it done and doing it to the best of your ability but not being too precious.
And I'm sure multiple jobs going at the same time.
Multiple jobs. And I sort of, you know, grew in the organisation and like really shadowed the owner of the company, and he sort of mentored me. He was a great role model and very intelligent guy. And, you know, there were so many different divisions within the company, there were just so many things to learn. I wasn't just learning about construction. I was learning about retail. I was learning about production. You know, we had 1 million square metres of nurseries. We had nurseries producing plants in Thailand.
Yeah.
But then, you know, we'd see freight over here for projects. It was just a crazy time.
Because I'm sure, you know, with big, massive budgets really compared to Australia.
Yeah.
When you've been doing.
Yeah.
So you were able to procure things from all over the world. Yeah. I mean, I think when I first met you, you'd got some olive trees.
Yeah.
From Spain?
I think they were actually from Portugal, but yeah.
And how old were they?
Well, apparently they were 3,000 years old. Yeah.
Right.
So how do you
find?
Look, that was pretty. That was actually a really. I mean, they were the sorts of projects that we'd get. You know, the guy was one of Dubai's wealthiest men. That project you're referring to, and you know, he had that sort of that traditional Arabic, you know, collector's hat. You know, like he just loved collections. He had the biggest collection of calligraphy. The biggest collection of silver in the world, the biggest, you know, collection of, you know, carpets. Like he was just into collecting stuff. And one of his passions was horticulture and trees. And
you would sit down one-on-one with him and
I mean, I'd sit in his majlis and there'd be, you know, Salvador Dali artworks in the majlis. Like incredible guy. And
how does he, because you're obviously, you know, nothing's impossible then.
Yeah.
How do you...
Whatever you want.
Yeah, but how do you...
Well, you just have to work it out. And, I mean, you kind of...
Is he giving you ideas or is he waiting for you to...
Well, no, like, so, you know, we'd done a design and he wanted the design to be a story of you know, that would really fascinate him. So we'd done this design where there were, like, different tales and a different garden. It was, like, based on 1001 Arabian Nights, and there were different gardens. There was, like, from this journey of this... Arabian Prince, sort of, it was like a tropical garden, there was like a Mediterranean garden, there was a, you know,
Infinity Contemporary Garden. It was all meant to be this journey he went on. Mm. And I just got a phone call one day to say, look, we've got 70 big olive trees arriving tonight. You know, you need to make sure they don't die because they're worth $100,000, I think it was, each. And, you know, I mean, that was crazy. Yeah. Even then, that was crazy.
So you had multiple projects going. Was it just the UAE or did you?
Originally just Dubai. Yeah. Then we did stuff. When I say Dubai, UAE, I mean, did a couple of island projects off Abu Dhabi for various rulers and royal family members. And, you know, they were amazing projects to be engaged in. And then I kind of evolved in the company and I was there for like 7 or 8 years. And I think by the end I was doing business development for them. Mm-hmm. And because we'd created, I mean, we went from, you know, I don't know, 400 or 500 staff when I joined in 2005 to 5,500 staff in like 4 years before the crash hit.
Okay.
Like insane growth, you know, revenue over 800 million from.
Yeah.
And arguably at one point we were the biggest landscape outfit, arguably in the world at one point. Like it was just insane how much we grew. And you know, how big you were, and to be part of that evolution of a corporate entity and be growing all the time was, you know, fascinating. Like,
and you mentioned the crash, and I mean, obviously, most of your clientele probably weren't affected as much as most people were, but I'm sure the business was affected
massively. You know, we had big corporate projects, like massive golf course estates with big signature names on them that just tanked. You know, they just went on hold and, you know, you had 1,000 staff dedicated to that job because of the timelines, because of budgets, you know, you had to really invest into them, you know, so, and payments then were sort of frozen. Definitely affected the group and as a result, you know, they had to really, we had to really reduce. So then that was another learning curve was having to go through that that horrible process of, you know, having those conversations with staff. And, you know, we just, I mean, I managed to survive in the company like a lot of people didn't. As you probably know, in construction, 08, 09, you know, it was pretty slim pickings, you know.
Sure.
But I think you're right. Like the stuff I was doing, in particular in the design and build stuff, was fairly secure.
Yeah, right.
Those high-profile clients still had money and still building amazing projects.
So that's when you spread further afield to get more projects?
Well, no, but then I sort of, because of restructuring the company, that's when I sort of got an opportunity a couple of years later to do business development. Mm-hmm. And that was interesting. You know, I was doing a lot of regional work, trying to, because there was a lot of other places in 2010 to 12, you know, things were starting to bounce back. And places like Qatar was, you know, well and truly trying to do what Dubai had done. I think by then maybe they'd won the games, so they were on a mission to do stuff. Saudi still hadn't really kicked off, but, you know, crazy meetings with interesting people like Gaddafi and his crew.
Really?
Lot of those countries were, you know, desperate, like looking at Dubai as kind of a role model, which it was, and wanting to do similar things. So
I'm sure he was a very interesting gentleman.
It was very short with him, but his sons were interesting. They wanted to do the airport, rebuild their whole airport, and they wanted us to design and build their whole experience in the landscape to that. So, you know, massive corporate commercial.
And was a lot of this opportunities word of mouth, you know, somebody would say, well,
I guess so, I guess our brand was just so big,
because did you advertise
the big hotels here? We did, you know.
Did you advertise, or was it like you got to use
a little bit, but I mean, I think
that's not how it works.
If you were in development and you wanted to build something big,
yeah,
you know, there were only a couple of companies, two or three companies then that you go to.
Okay. So it sounds like, I mean, we know that your story develops further. So, I mean, when was the next step and what was?
A couple of things happened. I think business development, it took me away from developing and building, but it definitely
put me in front of some fascinating, interesting mm-hmm. people and really taught me how to communicate with all sorts of different people, mm-hmm. you know, whether it was, you know, royal family members or whether it was, you know, really high profile people. And I think there's a skill in that. And so that was a great learning. And then, but I think I just, you know, I was looking for something different, but I wasn't advertising.
Yeah.
And by then I'd met my wife. I'd met Bex.
Oh, yeah.
Playing touch footy, of all things.
Wow.
She was working. She was amazing at branding and marketing. She was in that space. She worked for a big booze brand here. Mm-hmm. But she was sort of, she wanted a change from that industry.
Yep.
Obviously required a lot of late nights, and she was keen to do her own thing. So through the business development stuff I was doing, you know, we had all these nurseries here under Desert Group, and nursery production is very similar to agriculture here. So you have greenhouses, you have cooling pads to cool the, you know, the rooms that you plant all your seedlings in, grow your trees in. And it seemed like an opportunity for the company that I was in, the Desert Group, to maybe look at agriculture because it would be a very easy transfer of knowledge from, you know, our guys doing the nurseries. They could do agriculture, and it was just another spread, you know.
And was there, stretch into. And was there much of that at that stage?
Yeah, quite a lot. Quite a lot, but really poorly marketed and no brands and really poor access to market. So
who were they selling to?
Like Union Co-op and the co-ops, you know. There was an entity called Farmer Service Centre, which used to go and collect stuff and then distribute it.
Sure,
it was all on sort of government subsidies and,
right,
you know, you wouldn't really get the freshness of that product.
B2B.
Yeah, more like that. Yeah. But it was more of, I think it was still very new, and the variety of product that they were growing was fairly limited.
And the places like Spinney's and those were still importing everything?
Oh, yeah, heavily, yeah. There was very little of that product in your more premium offerings. But I was doing business development, looking at this opportunity for us to go into that. Now, it didn't really make sense for us, but I said to Bex, come for a drive with me to one of these farms on the weekend. Their product's amazing.
Yeah.
And she was very much into healthy eating at the time. Yeah. And I think she'd already started a lot of research and a lot of she'd actually started doing a bit of distribution for some organic products that weren't fresh food, but in the organic space. And like, she just fell in love with it. You know, she went to a couple of these farms, met farmers.
And they were passionate. All, they were, you know, all organic.
Yeah, the two or three that we went to were, and they were very highly certified, like US certified or European certified. Okay. They didn't have a certifying body in the UAE then.
So it was all there. They just needed a distributor, really.
They were more than happy. Someone who was as passionate as Bex and wanted to get going and get a market out, their product out there. So while I was still doing that, she set up a little farmer's market. And like literally the first time filled a Pajero or a, you know, 4x4, put the seats up and filled it with boxes of veggies.
Yeah.
And then drove it down and scattered them out all over a table. And I think just with her kind of marketing and branding ability and savviness, you know, within like 4 weeks she had traffic queuing down Shakeside Road.
How did you market there?
She just built a brand.
Built awareness.
Because
that was probably
just communicated hard and aggressively.
Was social media.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, we were on word of mouth. BlackBerry's end. We didn't have, you know, most people didn't have an iPhone or WhatsApp.
Yeah.
But she knew all the tools and how to get it out there.
Sure.
And she's very good at it.
Sure.
And I think she created a real following also from other, you know, similar food entities like bakeries and, you know, all those kind of people that wanted to be associated and sort of built this ever-growing market.
Yeah.
So that was while I was still at Desert. We'd set that up and I was helping her on weekends, packing boxes and stuff. And then I think around the same time, a member of a fairly high profile or very high profile family in Dubai, actually came in to the markets asking her questions about organic farming, and he was very passionate about farming, and she felt a bit overwhelmed. So she said, oh, why don't you chat to my husband? Like, he knows about all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then I started chatting this guy and got on really well with him and really liked him. And, you know, one thing led to another. And then through him, I got an opportunity to basically represent one of his brothers, and then later a lot, you know, the family to build their projects and develop their projects on a turnkey development cycle. So master plan, you know, design, infrastructure, roads, you know, water power drainage, architecture, and then oversee the build of all of these things. So really cool role. And I've been doing that pretty much ever since.
Oh, wow. And it's interesting how it didn't come from the original role. It came from a walk-in.
Yeah, I think.
Buying a few potatoes.
Yeah, I think it was a combination of just all that experience, though, of meeting these sorts of people you know, being able to communicate and not being overwhelmed, not feeling uncomfortable in a modulus or in those sorts of environments.
Yeah.
I think that helped. You know, incredibly welcoming and lovely family that, you know, been a big part of my life in the Middle East. And, you know, you become one of the family, you travel everywhere with them. And it's been a really fantastic. Cool story. Yeah.
Fantastic. And then, but going back to the right model, it's developed now, because originally you were in the garden center doing vegetables.
Yep.
Then was the next step to build the Almanara property?
No, so we started in the garden centre. We overgrew that space very quickly. Mm. We then moved to Saffa Park. So we're only doing, originally we were just doing markets.
That's right.
We had a spontaneous visit from His Highness Sheikh Mohammed, which was amazing. You know, we had...
The market.
Yeah, he popped into the market with his friends.
So before that, I mean, was there any markets, so to speak, of nothing?
No. So, look, there were the traditional markets he had kind of all over the world and in the Middle East, like down in Shindaga Tunnel. They call him a fruit and veg market.
Right.
But
yeah,
it was more the ripe market was more about supporting small businesses, giving them a platform, a cheap platform to launch their business.
Yeah.
So, you know, it could be a guy selling a fancy shirt or someone selling cookies.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't really matter. Provided they followed a certain criteria, then it was a platform for them.
And, absolutely.
You know, we wouldn't guarantee you could sell your shirts. But we would bring a big crowd if we could. And with your support, we all work together and everyone's sort of, you know, marketing it. And it was just something that was desperately needed. And it's been, I think, one of the most successful platforms for SMEs in the Middle East.
Yeah, of course. You had Saffa Park, and then obviously with the changes at Saffa, you moved to Zabil then?
Correct.
Zabil Park, I remember there. I remember you talking to them. And then obviously you were in Zabil. Was police college after that?
Yeah, and then we went to police college. So the transition now is that we've built our own space in the police academy, and you know, we've designed it and built it, and we have complete control of how we run that whole space in partnership with the police, who've been amazing.
Because I do remember at Zabil when somebody decided to start their own market sort of next door.
Yeah.
Was that right?
Like anything, I think if you do something well, there's always competition.
Yeah.
I think the trick is not to look at the competition, but just to keep being better.
Keep one step ahead.
Yeah. So we had loads of those sorts of things, even from a government level. But
so how did you? I mean, because the police college academy is a great spot. I mean, how did you even think and go to them and say you've got space? We want to use it.
I think they were the things I helped Bex with.
Right. No, but did you target that place?
Yeah,
that
definitely. Would be perfect? Yeah. Like, I mean, I knew the country pretty well. I knew the lay of the land fairly well. And, you know,
central
we wanted
spot.
A big space somewhere central, somewhere which was an opportunity to kind of really activate a community.
But wasn't there proposed to put hotels in there at some stage?
There's been a lot of proposals. Dubai Holdings, the big development outfit, have plans there. I'm sure at some stage they'll roll them out. Who knows? Hopefully we've created enough momentum as a community that we keep going. But, you know, it's a great space for us. The police have been a fantastic support. And
so will that area will continue to grow, or will you, because you've obviously got a big car park area that you can utilize, or that'll
I think we're pretty comfortable with that. So it's constantly evolving. I don't know how much we're going to grow it, but we're in the process now of building a really fantastic new project down in Festival City with Alpha Tame, which I can officially announce.
You're breaking the news on the captain's table? Breaking the news
on the table, yeah.
Wow.
Here it is.
Great. So, make sure we record this.
So it's a huge opportunity for us, and we're thrilled.
So it'll be a similar footprint?
Very different. So we're activating the Festival City Mall, the whole bay.
Yep.
So they've got an enormous light show there called Imagine. Uh-huh. And we're basically building all these custom kiosks that are going to run all the way around it, and different activations, live music, live food, bringing in partners.
The ability for people to utilize that to sell their
Correct. Markets. So it's a platform again for SME businesses, and it's going to be in coordination with Expo.
Wow.
So it's going to run for 6 months, and it's what's unique is it's a night market. So, if you want to sell your shirts, you get a custom made 3x3 meter kiosk, not a tent like we have in the police academy.
Yep.
Really beautiful kiosks. Perfect. And it's locked up during the day. And then every day of the week at 4 p.m. it rolls up. And it's going to be really exciting.
So you're going to have Ripe and this going at the same time. Any other ones as well, or is that going to keep you busy enough?
We're always getting approached, but our big focus is on delivering that and doing it well.
Sure.
We've only got 2.5 months
to
get it ready. So we've literally this week just gone out there to start approaching vendors and companies to get involved. And we're full steam ahead with production of everything there. So it's a big project. It's a really big project.
So summer months are obviously your downtime, but I'm thinking you're always thinking, is there any way to, because you do some work in Springs Mall?
So we're all over actually. We're in we're in Murdoch, we're in Springs, we're on the Palm.
Sure.
With Nikhil. We go indoors basically in summer, and this year's been actually has been officially our best summer.
Right.
I think we've got good captive audience here. Like a lot of people haven't travelled, and we've got the ingredients, the team, we've got the strategy right. So it's actually been a lot busier than we've experienced before. And we really go big in winter. And I think what'll be unique about this one will be it'll be a night concept. Mm-hmm. Whereas the police academy is more in the day and more of maybe a family,
family
kind of orientated thing.
To kick off again, pre-start of Expo, or obviously it starts to cool down September.
So like mid-October, towards the end of October.
Right.
Official launch date isn't confirmed, but we'll be trying to get
people
selling their shirts early October.
I think we need to get the shirts down there.
The police academy will continue, and then we'll wait and see what happens in Abu Dhabi, because they've had a very strict lockdown of events since COVID started. So,
but a plan if it does open up.
Traditionally partnered up with Umm Emirat Park down there, and we'd like to continue that, but we'll just they're obviously right now in a big cleansing program. So,
obviously. The cornerstone of this is Ripe and the organic foods. With COVID, everybody changed their mentality when it came to buying, and I'm sure you had a lot more competition.
Yeah, interesting, interesting journey. I've been talking a lot about Ripe Events, which is the event management company, which does the markets and does other events.
Ripe Organic, so we actually had to split to two companies, you know, several years ago.
Mm.
Ripe Organic is the organic trading company that, you know, has retail shops and,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's been a really interesting journey. Like when we started it, we were the only people doing it. Mm-hmm. We, you know, there were a couple of people who'd done it before us and hadn't really taken off. And, you know, we were working with a lot of farms rather than trying to be a farmer and do it ourselves. We were kind of trying to support all the local farms.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we had anywhere at the time in our first year, we had like 11 different farms that we mm-hmm. worked with. And they all had to tick the criteria.
Sure.
But then we were trying to support them and move their product. But I think, you know, to Becky's credit, like she really put the organic, local organic scene very much in the forefront of people's minds. Like I think there were these little cult followings in certain places, but I think widespread, you know, she was at all the big hotels. She was dealing with all the big commercial players.
And was there anybody
far before anyone else?
Yeah, there was no one really.
No one doing it. There was certainly no branded products
no.
going into, you know, supermarkets and stuff like that. Mm. But then what happened was there was a real trend to go into organic from the big supermarket chains.
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, similarly in other countries, you can't compete with them, right? So, so we'd gone out and expanded our retail,
sure,
but then we were competing against, you know, Carrefour and Spinneys and all these guys, and it just didn't make sense. So we kind of shrunk that, and we realized when things did change, especially in COVID, even though there was more of a movement towards healthy eating and more health, people were a lot more conscious of their budget and their spend, and organic's expensive. So, you know, we try to make it more affordable, and we tried to go more into your big wholesalers and your retailers like you know, Carrefour and those guys.
Right.
So it was just a change in the model. We had to evolve, move quickly.
Yeah.
Mike Craig, who's our GM, is amazing. He's really sharp. He's on it. He's constantly trying to grow it and, you know, kind of move with the times because they do change very quickly. It's a challenging industry. Perishable foods.
Yes.
You don't have long to kind of
get
it right. But it's, you know, I think Ripe Organic has got a great brand and it's got a great, you know, great following, and it's done a lot for the agricultural movement.
Dubai. I think anyway. Coming from the COVID time when air flights went to absolutely zero, I think it was a massive wake up call in the fact that this country could run out of food very quickly.
Correct.
And from that, was there any other, did anybody else recognize that, and was there any more efforts put in for additional farms?
Like the government has a huge investment in food security. It's not necessarily related to agriculture here, you know. There's some fundamental challenges here with agriculture, obviously water, scarcity. Power is not everywhere. Where the agricultural land, there's not necessarily power. And it's arid, it's hot.
You know,
so several months of the year, you struggle to grow anything unless you grow it in greenhouses, you know, cooling pads and all the things we talked about earlier. So I think the government's looked at new technologies, new methods of farming that can handle the heat, and they've invested in that. That's not necessarily organic. It's like hydroponics and things like that. And they've also invested heavily in agriculture around the world and regionally. So, I think that way they can potentially control their food sourcing.
I think there was something I read about what they're doing in Indonesia.
All over the world, you know, like literally all over the world. Massive projects in Sudan, in, you know, in Georgia, in, you know, all over. Right. So, doesn't necessarily relate to farming here because of the obvious challenges, but it secures their food.
Sure.
So it's been a really interesting journey on the organic side, and we're constantly trying to evolve and move. We've got some exciting plans. We just at the moment, I think some businesses are just sort of in a survival mode kind of mentality with COVID. And, you know, marginal growth. I think there's a lot of companies that have fallen over, you know, as you probably know, over the last 18 months. So, you know, we're really proud. We've continued to grow, and Mike's done a great job.
No, that's great.
That's organic.
So, I mean, what we always like to ask people is why they love this place.
Yeah.
Why they love Dubai. What's the main reasons that make you stay here, bring your children up? What do you particularly love about this place?
It's a really good question. I think I probably should have an answer that I just spit out to that, shouldn't I?
Well, we have a lot. We ask the same question to everybody, and we have some very different answers. So,
look, personally, what's this place given me? You know, I met my wife here, which just has given me so much. I've got three amazing kids, you know, with her, and can't take that away from Dubai. You know, I've my career and my personal growth, I think, has been, you know, massively elevated here. You know, you can't really, you never know something like that. You know, you can't really have a real measure or something like that. But I think of the exposure I've had to opportunities here, it's just been unbelievable. From a business perspective, I mean, I've set up, you know, companies here. And, you know, they've been fantastic journey and experience. I think Dubai just gives that opportunity. It's absolutely, like, you know, it's this open-minded, rapidly growing place that it's constantly after, you know, improvement. So I think if you know, you've got an attitude that's in the right place, you work hard and you're passionate, I think there's just so much opportunity here. And not many roadblocks. Like, I think, you know, they try and support as much as they can you to grow. I mean, you know, like the right market, you know, it's, like I said, a platform for small businesses. There's so many success stories that have come out of that, you know, initial platform, whether it's, you know, a local brother and sister selling their homemade cookies to now having one of the biggest franchises of, you know, cafe brands in the region and being all over Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Saudi. You know, there's like, and a big part of that is because we're in Dubai. So yeah, there's so many things.
So I'm just thinking, if someone's listening and they have a product like shirts, and they wanted to come to Right Market, what do they do?
We're online. Rightme.com. We've got you can go through all the different application processes there for the markets, and
until you do it.
There's contact numbers, you can pick up the phone and call, or I think the best way to do it is to maybe go to one of them, whether it's an indoor one or the outdoor markets, and understand what it's all about. And then go online and fill an application form and send away your idea. And it's pretty easy to support for us to support a lot of companies. We don't charge much money to give a great platform.
Perfect.
That's the whole model. So
we'll put the website on the Insta
let's see what we do.
James, thank you so much for coming on the Captain's Table today. We've
pleasure.
Certainly learned a lot about you and what's going on. And roll on the expo.
Bring it on. Get down to one of our markets. We'd love to see you there.
Exactly.
Come buy one of Jimmy's shirts.
Thanks, James.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this interesting story with Mr. James Balderstone. I certainly did, and learned a lot. If you like what we're doing with our Dubai stories, please subscribe to our YouTube page. And we'll keep going and more stories. Thanks, guys.